This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcast on. And while you're there, rate and review us. Today, we are broadcasting, recording from Freedom Fest in Las Vegas. It's the world's largest annual event of libertarians and free market enthusiasts, and we're at the Paris Hotel in Las Vegas. I am talking to Barry Weiss, who is an op-ed writer and editor at the New York Times, and she is one of the finalists for the Bastiat Prize, which is something Reason gives out on an annual basis to people who celebrate human freedom and individual innovation and free minds and free markets. Barry, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Nick.
Now, yeah, and I stumbled like freedom, over your name because you said people are constantly mispronouncing. How do they mispronounce your name?
They say Bari.
Bari, because you spell it B-A-R-I.
Well, yeah, my parents spelled it that way, okay, so that well, got yeah. stuck with it.
Yeah,
I don't even have a middle name.
Now you can't change your name. I mean, that can't happen. So, all right. So, well, let's
Well, can I ask you one thing?
Okay, sure.
Because we met at the Times a few weeks ago,
yes.
And you were going to be in New York for the weekend. I asked if you had any exciting plans.
Yes.
And you said, which surprised me, that you were going to maybe be microdosing on LSD or taking
yes.
LSD. And I've been thinking about it.
Yeah, I did not. I don't think I did either of those things, but I also don't really remember what I did off the top of my head. So it's quite possible that I macrodosed.
Old or because drugs?
I don't think it's old. I have a pretty good memory. and I'm not that old. But yeah, so I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly what I did. But I, obviously I didn't get arrested. I may have been put into a simulation. I don't know. So, and you were going to the Aspen Ideas Festival that week.
I was.
And
wow.
Well, let's talk about that. This is you see, I have a good memory.
Yes, you do.
And everybody in New York was basically going to the Aspen Ideas Festival.
Yes.
Every homeless person, finally you could get a seat on the subway or get on the, on the free Wi-Fi in Bryant Park because all the hobos were in Aspen. But the Aspen Ideas Festival.
To be clear, I was the hobo of Aspen in every way.
And you interviewed Jordan Peterson,
yes.
right? The philosopher king of kind of the alt-right or the intellectual dark web, which is probably...
Well, I don't think those things are interchangeable.
We can talk about that. But you wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine about the intellectual dark web that came out, about a month ago, 6 weeks ago?
I think it was like 2 months ago.
Okay.
Maybe
so,
more.
That was a widely talked about piece and widely attacked because, everybody who wasn't in it attacked it for not including them or for including them, et cetera. What is the intellectual dark web and what drew you to writing about it?
Okay, and then I want to get back to Aspen, which
yeah.
was a totally bizarre experience.
Mm-hmm.
What drew me to write about it was, I forget when it was, maybe like 5 months ago, or I had written some piece. And I noticed that someone tweeted at me or tweeted at Eric Weinstein, who's the guy who dubbed this phenomenon,
right.
the intellectual dark
and
web.
And he is the brother of Brett Weinstein, who was
ousted from Evergreen
Green State College, along with his wife, and physically threatened for...
Opposing a day of racial segregation.
Right. And he's a left-wing hard scientist.
Yes. Occupy Wall Street supporting right. Bernie voting guy.
Right.
Anyway, someone...
But his brother is a bigwig in Silicon Valley, kind of venture capital, and is a filthy billionaire who is more libertarian,
I actually
right?
don't know if he's a billionaire.
Okay, let's call him a centimillionaire.
Okay.
It's kind of an insult.
He works for Peter Thiel, so
yeah.
that's
okay.
sort of the shorthand. But he himself also a Bernie supporter, also... I mean,
Eric Weinstein.
Eric,
wait,
yes.
And
Eric
Brett and Brett.
Yes,
okay.
They're very... sort of unpredictable
so,
politically.
So a Peter Thiel employee
yes.
is a Bernie Sanders supporter,
yes.
whereas Peter Thiel was a delegate to the for Trump at the Republican
Correct.
National Convention.
Okay. It's one of the interesting stories. I think someone needs to do a story called The Other Weinstein Brothers, because
uh-huh.
the two of them are quite
yeah.
interesting themselves. Anyway, someone tweeted at Eric something like, give this lady an invitation to the intellectual dark web,
right.
to which he said something like, She needs no invitation or some quip like that. And I was like, intellectual dark web, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And I sort of realized that I was adjacent to it already without calling it that. The people who are in it that I talk about in my mm-hmm. article are people like, Sam Harris that have sort of mm-hmm. been on the scene for a long time. But also a lot
who is single-handedly turning people off of atheism and back to religion, right? Just as by sheer personal force.
I am not with him on the atheism front. But I... But there's kind of group of people who, some of them are like Brett and Heather. You could even say Alice Dreger is sort of adjacent mm-hmm. to it. Other people that...
And these are scientists, basically, who are increasingly fed up with what they see as a kind of politically correct orthodoxy being imposed on just basic science.
Yes, there is an inordinate number of people from hard science backgrounds in it, but it's also other academics,
right.
People like Christina Hoff Summers, people
right.
that are...
Who 25 years ago wrote a book, Who Lost Feminism.
Exactly.
Where she was coming out of a feminist, she was a philosophy professor.
Right. She's an equity yeah. second wave feminist who's right. now called a fascist when
right.
she regularly goes speaks on college campuses. Yeah. So there's
maybe
sort of...
it's the Eva Braun outfit. That's why she's called a... I don't know. You know, the cosplay might be a part. But...
I think what it is just, you know, it's a sort of a crazy name. Some people yeah. love it. Some people hate it. I think it's sort of playful. But what it is it's a reaction to the fact that the Overton window is becoming increasingly narrow.
Okay. And now the Overton window, and I'm just stopping you. I think I know what it is. And I know it's a major competitor to Pella windows, but the Overton window.
Let me put it in other language. So we don't need to use jargon. Views that 5 years ago were commonsensical are now being smeared as bigoted mm-hmm. or radical. This phenomenon is, I think, largely a reaction to that.
Right.
And what's fascinating to me about it, and it could be written about from this perspective too, is that it's kind of just a very grassroots sort of event and publishing phenomenon, almost more than anything else. The fact that tens of thousands of people are lining up and going and paying large sums of money to sit in an arena for 2.5 hours and to see two white dudes sitting in leather chairs talking about the nature of truth,
mm-hmm.
that's a fascinating thing that's going on. And you have to ask yourself sort of why that is and to what extent the institutions that are supposed to be housing those conversations are failing, that they're happening in places like YouTube and, you know, in arenas around the world.
Right. So talk about Jordan Peterson. I mean, because he in many ways is the, I'm trying to think of, is he the Sinatra of the intellectual dark web or is he the Ramones? I mean, in a weird way, part of the problem, I think, with the concept of the intellectual dark web is, first off, it's very self-flattering. It's like we're the Silk Road. We're, you know, the cryptocurrency of smart people on the web, and we're too hot to be talked about on college campuses or on regular media. So we're out there in the alt media, which is kind of interesting. But Jordan Peterson, a Toronto, University of Toronto psychologist mm-hmm. who was I don't want to say undistinguished academic, but he was a...
He had published one book.
Yeah, which is, you know, come on, let's get working a little bit here. But he was
To be fair, he was also, like, taking patients. Like, he's not just a professor.
Yeah, well, you know, but I suspect the University of Toronto...
Not everyone can be as prolific as you, Nicholas.
Yeah, I guess so. But he pushed back against a perception or a possible law in Canada where mm-hmm. he said that he would not be told what pronouns to use or what language to use while doing his job.
Right. He interpreted the bill as being sort of
right.
compelled speech and opposed
right.
it on free
yeah.
speech grounds. It was one of those, you know, viral YouTube
yeah.
incidents. It catapulted him to fame. And then he's had this book, 12 Rules for Life,
right.
which is, you know, I think still like the number one bestseller. It's
right.
sold over a million copies, translated into 40 languages. And I'm really interested in...
Some of which don't even exist, but that's that's what's so fascinating about it.
Well, so what's interesting to me is, you know, I've read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen many, many hours of his YouTube talks. I had not met him till,
right.
you know, a week ago or 2 weeks ago in Aspen. But every time I was walking around reading this book in any public place, tons of people were coming up to me saying that this book and his ideas changed their life.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it really fascinating because a lot other than the Jungian stuff, let's put that to
right.
the side for a second. The book is, you know, the chapters are things like make your bed. You know, it's
right.
very sort of like conservative home truths.
Right.
And I'm really curious about why it is that seems so fresh and radical.
Who is his audience? And I realize, again, I brought up a kind of CBGBs or the Ramones. And the intellectual dark web is this broad term in the same way. If you know about like the bands that played at CBGB's in the 70s, in the late 70s, that broadly
you're
seen
talking
as punk.
To the most musically ignorant
yeah, I'm
person.
Yeah, I'm not actually talking to you.
It's like
I'm talking
Indigo
past
Girls
you.
And nothing. Yeah, okay. Talk past me to your audience.
So, what I mean is that, so you had bands like the Ramones, and you had bands like Television and Richard Hell, and Patti Smith and Bruce Springsteen played there. And
I know those two.
And Talking Heads. And like in the end, they don't actually have that much in similar musically, but they all were in the same place. So it became kind of,
sure,
this
like
is the what
New York
the movement
like yeah. The New York Intellectuals, like at one time they shared a lot and then they all sort of broke apart.
Right. Or the Beats, I mean, where, you know, when you start looking at the themes, but much less the styles of William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg.
Right.
I mean, like, they
right.
were
does
friends.
It, right.
It's
it
a sociological phenomenon, but not necessarily an integrated aesthetic or philosophical movement.
Yes, and that might be the case. I think that is a very fair way of describing them. What I find so interesting is that they are embracing, for there to be something going on in our extremely sort of balkanized landscape in which a Ben Shapiro and a Sam Harris are high-fiving and saying, let's talk about things.
Let's have a conversation about how evil Islam is. Because that's what they agree on, right? That's what they totally agree on, that Islam is a religion of hate.
I do not think that that is what they believe. And as we've talked about before, I think that that's an unfair characterization.
Okay, fair enough. But they want to talk about abortion.
The point is they want to talk about, they're willing to talk. I mean, I know this sounds so like, it's almost heartbreakingly basic, but show me another group of people that are talking across difference in a civil way, in good faith, in the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that is.
Okay, and so that's also somebody like Dave Rubin. You know, and I would say Dave Rubin and Ben Shapiro are not, and I don't mean this pejoratively, it's strictly descriptive, they're not intellectuals.
Well, it's a mix of people.
Yeah,
they're,
because
right,
like so Weinstein, Brett Weinstein, Heather, his wife, Sam Harris, and whether you agree with their ideas or not, and I'm not sure that
John
I...
John McWhorter. After this came out, Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter raised their hands and they were like, we're the black wing of the IDW.
Right. And they are, I mean, these are academics. These are people with PhDs. These are people who are trying to apply a fairly rigorous analytic methodology to stuff. And, you know, that's one wing of it. And then there are people like Dave Rubin and Ben Shapiro who house or host conversations, like you're saying, across different belief systems, which is kind of interesting. I think you hit on something when you said, you know, this is why, you know, this should be being hosted on, I don't know, CBS Sunday Morning. It should be being hosted on college campuses. It's no longer being hosted there. And we have this alternative media. Sam Harris is a podcast star. Ben Shapiro, podcast star.
We haven't mentioned Rogan. I mean, Rogan's...
Again, nobody's idea of an intellectual.
No, but Rogan has one of the... Right, but why? Yeah. You have to ask yourself, why are people like Brett or Neil Ferguson or Majid Nawaz or whoever, going on this show for 3 hours that then, you know, there's a really, I thought, one of the most interesting anecdotes in the piece came from Michael Shermer, who said, you know, he's riding along a road and he passes a construction crew.
By the way, he always is riding about every story that Michael Shermer tells. Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, nobody cares. You know, it's like,
I don't get off a couch. But he does, apparently. Anyway, guy working a construction site. Yeah. Like, you know, he's in sort of I'm sorry, Michael Shermer, you're very handsome. Yeah. But anyway, he stopped by a guy working the construction site and he's like, aren't you Michael Shermer? I listen to you on Joe Rogan. That's fascinating to me. You know, and it's like people were annoyed that I was somehow pointing out a phenomenon that exists.
Right.
It's like this exists in the world.
And they're going to take it out on you. It's also interesting in a way, and let's talk about your position at the New York Times and your journalism history. Because when were you hired by the Times editorial page?
A year ago.
Okay. You know, this is also the type of thing that you would expect to be discussed, you know, regularly within the weak perspective sections of newspapers like the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post. And it seems harder and harder to do that. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it strikes me that, of course, this stuff is not going to be happening in the academy, which is not in a political sense, but in a kind of slow moving sense. It's the most conservative institution by design in like Western civilization. If universities are supposed to kind of be sluggish because, you know, everything's supposed to be vetted and we're making sure that we're moving forward seriously and slowly, et cetera. media is like that. Of course, Fox News isn't going to have a bunch of like serious lefties on because their whole audience is, you know, hardcore righties. MSNBC,
right.
Similar.
But it's so, also the
but it's old media. I mean, it's old media versus new media.
Well, and it's also, I mean, one thing that has been interesting to me to think about that again seems basic, but I think is really worth considering, which is the format of these shows, mm-hmm. right, of an MSNBC or a Fox. It's like not every conversation ought to be contained into a 3 or 6 minute segment.
Right.
The fact that these podcasts can go on for 3 hours, mm-hmm. and guess what? People are in their cars a lot. People are in their subway. Like,
or they
that's
stop
a radical
doing
thing.
What they're doing to listen. I mean, this is one of the things that I have found fascinating about cable TV in particular, is that over time it has gotten cable news. It started out more freeform. It was like FM radio almost in the beginning, or 15 or 20 years ago, where you would have odd conversations that were not what you got on ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Right.
But now it is such a rigid and turgid setup where, you know, like, oh, that's all we have time for. It's like, what are you fucking talking about? Like, all you have is time.
Exactly.
And people,
you have to fill 24 hours a day every single day.
Yeah, you know, and
but it's like, when's the last time you heard something fresh on a cable
news
show
I
ever?
No, I agree. Yeah, no, and one of the things
surprising.
That I've been amazed at with the, you know, with the rise of kind of online video, and Reason got into that space very early. Online, you know, just discussions on, you know, whether it's writing longer, because newspapers were always like, oh, you know, it's got to be 600 words. If it's an opinion piece, it better be really good if it's going to be 700 words or 800 words, because there were space constraints. All of space and time disappears online. And yet you have to go back to the early 70s and these bizarre talk shows of my youth.
Yeah.
Of things like the Dinah Shore Show, or,
right.
you know, where Dinah would have Orson Welles, you know, Muhammad Ali, and
yes.
Ralph Nader on.
Or Firing Line.
Stuff. Yeah, which has been reborn
right.
as a half-hour show as opposed to an hour or 90-minute show.
Right. Still, it's the most luxurious thing, the idea of one guest for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like unthinkable now,
right.
which is crazy.
So in a way, I mean, this, I don't know if you're a McLuhanite at all, a Marshall McLuhan, but, you know, that the medium is the message, and that when you have new technologies or new communication systems, you know, that's what dictates it. The content is less important than what gets, you know, how the network changes things. And mm-hmm. it's almost like, because we can have free form conversations now via podcasts, via YouTube videos and things like that, we're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and it's
a
starved market.
Well, one thing I just found quite interesting, just one more point mm-hmm. on Peterson, you talked about who his audience is. I was meeting recently with some, you know, cable news execs mm-hmm. for various reasons, and I asked all of them in individual meetings, do you know who Jordan Peterson is? Not one of them knew who he was.
Right.
I found that absolutely shocking.
It's kind of fascinating that the Times knows who he is, to be quite honest. And I'm not saying you, but I'm saying, yeah, of course they don't know, because they're the mainstream. They are the, you know, they're your father's Oldsmobile. They you know, stuff comes to them late. And that's, I think, true of the mainstream media for the most part. So kudos to you for muscling in an intellectual dark web piece into,
thanks,
you know, the graveyard of print journalism, otherwise known as the New York Times.
Well, to be fair, it didn't appear in print. It was just online.
Is that right?
Yep.
So, okay, well, that's good, because who needs print,
well,
right? We want to save the planet.
It gave me 3,000, you know, gave me room, which,
yeah.
you know, is amazing.
Which is, and again,
and in
you
general,
know,
you know, that's been the most incredible part about the Times. I think like two of my pieces of 50 or 40 or whatever have been in print. The rest has been online, and I don't even.
It's amazing, because I remember, this was about 20 years ago. I moved to a town where you couldn't even get the Times on Sunday delivered. It was a small town in Ohio. And then the Sunday Times, you could get that delivered, but not daily. And they didn't really have an online presence. And it was kind of fascinating. Like, oh, you know, finally I can read the New York Times in the Sunday edition, where they would let things go long. And it's, I don't remember the last time I've felt a print copy of the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or New York Times, because you want, you know, it exists online.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, who needs it, especially if it's going to enforce these arbitrary, technologically driven
yes.
constraints of, oh, you know, it can only 1,500 words. that's like a, you know, a fucking doctoral dissertation in a newspaper, right?
Right.
And although you're barely getting warmed
up. My youngest
up.
Sister is an intern right now at the New York Post, and they still work. She said to me the other day, Barry got 25 inches to write this story. And I'm like, what
does that even mean?
Sort of love it, though. I do read the Post.
No, the New York Post is a fascinating article, a fascinating newspaper. And the one thing that's great about it is for centuries now, it was founded by Alexander Hamilton. As it gets more and more tabloidy, the portrait of Hamilton on the cover gets bigger and bigger until he's almost blocking out, you know, the bikini babes or something. Okay, so let's talk about your journalism career. You came to the Times from the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
What were you doing there?
So I had done two jobs at the Journal. The first stint, which was basically my first real job, I was at the New York Sun.
How old are you?
I'm 34.
Okay.
My first job was...
The New York Sun.
Yes.
Okay, so this...
The late, great, babe.
Yeah, no, the New York Sun was an interesting alternative paper. You know what I loved about the New York Sun? I didn't agree with most of its politics, some of it, but it was the cultural coverage was actually really interesting.
It was
like the New York Observer, et cetera.
Exactly, which was edited by Robert Messenger, who later became my boss at the Journal. So anyway, get hired at the New York Sun. I'm too naive to realize, like, why am I getting hired? Because, oh, by the way, it's hemorrhaging a ton of money and it's about to close. But I was there during the Lehman Brothers collapse. You know, I think on my second day, they were like, Barry, go sneak into a Lehman Brothers, you know, investors meeting. Like, it was very exciting and fun. There for a very short time. Then I go to the Journal, where I had been a Bartley Fellow, which is like a summer internship. I was there for 4 years as an op-ed editor, left for 2 years, went to Tablet, which is an online Jewish magazine, which does
also
amazing stuff.
Great cultural coverage. We're going to argue about politics in a little bit.
And great column. I mean, Wesley Yang, like they're publishing some really amazing people.
Again, does that even have a print edition?
I
mean, that's something. And again, I think the Daily Beast does this and a couple of publications that are either were native to the web or whatever, where they're like, you know what? We're not constrained by the formats of our technological forebearers, so we can be more interesting. It's also true when you're an editor, I'm an editor, when you give people unlimited space, they can be boring in unlimited ways. But they can also be, people can be boring in 500 words.
I really, I like concision, but sometimes you do need more space or something longer. So there for 2 years, then I go back to the Journal, and I was a book review editor there for 3 years. Robert Messenger was my boss, Robert Messenger, who edited the cultural stuff at the New York Sun. The long and short of it is that basically, so unlike the Times, at the Journal, the book review section falls under the purview of the editorial page editor. Mm-hmm. So that's all under Paul Jagot and you know.
Why are we hiring a Frenchman or a guy with a French name for a job many Americans would do?
Exactly. So basically what happened was Trump happened. Mm-hmm. You might have heard of him. And I, along with some people were fired. Others of us sort of self-deported. And that's how
were you one of the self-deportees?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And why were people being fired?
Well, there's a very good story. I remember it being very good. Sam Tannenhaus did a good story, which addresses the firing of Mark Laswell, who was the op-ed editor who...
was insufficiently pro-Trump?
Exactly. Yeah. And now he's at the Washington Post, as of a few weeks ago, actually.
Yeah. Where he is insufficiently anti-Trump.
Right. This is our fate. Brett and I ended up at the Times. And
Brett Stevens.
Yeah. Sourab Amari ended up at Commentary. Mm-hmm. And then various other people who probably don't want to be named. but it was a very... clarifying year, I would say. It was really interesting to see how, you know, the Journal's editorial page motto is free people, free markets.
Right.
I'm looking at the reason sign. They're
ripping us off completely. and it wouldn't be the first time. But by the way, I love being published in the Wall Street Journal. So, you know, I'm just being descriptive.
There's a lot of great things about it. My dad still writes op-eds for them. And I can't, you know, I had a...
Who is your dad?
He's a carpet salesman in Pittsburgh. He writes op-eds from time to time. His name's Lou Weiss.
Okay. And is it from like a Michael Shermer thing where he's like, I was selling some carpet. This is a mid-range price, deep pile, shag. You know, it's coming back. Yeah.
So he, what was I telling you? Lou, carpet,
journal. What happened?
Overall, I mean, can't say enough. Like it was a great place to work. But basically it was really disturbing to me to watch as they sort of, it became clear he was going to be the nominee, decided to support someone who was an affront to almost, the values that we claim to care about.
Right. At the Journal. And of course, you know, the Wall Street Journal has every right to, you know, hire and fire whoever they want based on ideology,
of course,
of that kind of stuff.
You don't
want to be there.
No, yeah. It's more that people that I thought I was always the most sort of left-wing person at the Journal, but I agreed with the Journal.
Which meant that the people who died in the Shirtwaist Triangle Factory fire didn't fully deserve it?
Yeah, something like that. So I look forward to that being ripped out of context.
Yes.
But I was always sort of on board enough had enough shared values that sort of worked. And then it was just a real, I don't know if you've ever had this, a very jarring experience to see that people that you thought you shared some fundamental sort of moral values in common with, and certainly political ones, to have that revealed to not be the case was just really hard.
Can you speculate? Did they, I mean, was it a heartfelt conversion? And I'm going to be vaguely anti-Semitic here and say, like St. Paul or Saul of Tarsus. Was it a true conversion, a Damascus Road experience, or was it like, we're going to be selling papers and we want to butter up the guy who might win the...
I think it was a few things. I think it was, a lot of Journal readers. I think it was a business decision of not wanting to isolate our readers. Mm-hmm. I would say, there was a lot of conversation about who our readers supported. But then also a feeling of, he might be the guy and, he's an imperfect vessel, but, mm-hmm. and this was a big thing that was being sort of bandied about at the time, but, Paul Ryan's going to be able to sort of fill him up with good ideas and
Paul Ryan had plenty of time to come up with good ideas. He never did. And
so
then to the extent,
right.
So
it was just, it was just shocking to me that we had, whenever it came to matters, let's say of economic policy, they were willing to really go to the mat. But when it came to punching back against things that were just such a moral affront, they really...
Give an example of that.
I'm trying to think what we said about Judge Curiel or mm-hmm. Grab Him by the Pussy or all
right,
these
yeah.
things, like, where it was just...
Well, and certainly
so
the,
unforgivable.
Yeah, and it's a slightly different than that. It's related to economic policy, I think, but the Journal for decades was the place where open borders, right of center people
Definitely.
Or left of center people, and certainly libertarians could say, immigrants, people who want to come here and work here should be allowed to, and they're good people, and that's what America is all about. And that was stunning when the Wall Street Journal was suddenly like, immigrants are a problem, et cetera.
Well, I think it was this. They had this attitude of, we're going to be like the umpire. We're going to call the balls and strikes as we see them. And when he does something good, we'll praise him. When he does something bad, blah, blah, blah. But it's a myopic way of thinking about the problem
right.
of who he is and what he's doing to the culture. And I just found it really heartbreaking, honestly, that we didn't have something bigger to say about.
How did it affect, you were editing book reviews and things like that. How did it factor into that kind of
coverage? Didn't. No, yeah. it largely didn't. Mm-hmm. Really what it was, if I was a sort of fundamentally literary, it was clarifying for me too. Meaning I could have been happily spent, and it's an amazing book review section that
right.
I love and still read.
Yep.
I could have spent the next decade doing that. But watching Trump's rise was clarifying for me in terms of, I really care about sort of being in the arena on political and cultural questions. And I'm not going to be happy if I stay doing book reviews, and I want to sort of get back into the scrum. And in fact, I really want to be writing more than I ever have before.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the things that sort of became clear to me. And I wanted to find a place where I could do that. And I was sort of shocked that it's turned out to be the Times.
So, and now one of the things that was interesting when your former Wall Street Journal colleague Brett Stevens got hired by the New York Times, and then yourself a bit after that, right?
Yeah, I was Yes, it was.
But people were like, oh, you know, what the fuck? Now the New York Times is like bringing in a bunch of, Jewish right wingers. So it's like,
right.
Oh, they're pro-Israel and all of this kind of stuff. Where was that coming from? And is that a, does it represent a fundamental shift? And it might be a good one, or an opening up of the New York Times opinion section, that they're hiring, and obviously there are people like David Brooks and Ross Douthat and whatnot, who have been there for a while. And there was always, William Safire, whoever, there was always the token conservative or whatever. Is the New York Times, do you think, is it also in a way to appeal to its audience, which it suddenly realizes isn't just a bunch of, left wing, or not even left wing, but just liberal intellectual types, upper income people. But there's, are they hiring guys like you in order to appeal to their market audience?
I think it's a really sort of I'm not sure. I don't have a great sense still of who the Times reader is, as opposed to the Journal reader, where I had a really, really good sense because I was there for a long time. It's very hard to separate the signal from the noise with Times readers, because a lot of people on Twitter seem to read at least Times headlines and get extremely pissed off about things. Do they represent the average Times reader? I'm not so sure. In terms of what James Bennett is trying to do, he's the he's the editorial page editor. I think.
And he had formerly
been
at
the Atlantic
and
whatnot. Then, but before that, had been a Timesman,
right,
and was the Jerusalem bureau chief. I really, really think.
Times man. What are we in, a Henry James novel or something like
isn't
that?
It's fun to say that.
No, it isn't.
Oh, it's fun for me.
It disgusts me. But
he's vomiting on me right now.
It's fun for you, of course, because you're now, are you a Times woman or a Times gal?
I don't know. I'm like an interloper.
Okay,
I don't know what I am.
But
he really, what I mean to say when I'm saying that a little bit cheekily is like, he's of the Times.
Yeah.
Like, and he, and he really, really, I do think, is going out of his way, not just in, hiring me and Brett, but also Jennifer Senior is going to do, a podcast column, basically. Michelle Alexander, he's hired a bunch of people. But yes, I certainly think that he believes that the op-ed page shouldn't just exist sort of as a warm bath for people. And it should be a place where they're really engaging with more intellectual diversity.
Right.
And I feel really, really lucky to work for him.
And it's good. It's interesting to see, the establishment venue actually kind of bringing a different set of voices and conversations. Maybe the university, maybe cable TV, maybe public TV is just not really serving.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting and odd. I wouldn't have expected it to be the New York Times. In a lot of ways, the New York Times is where trends go to die. It's the certifier. Mm. It's the lagging indicator, I think, of where thought has gone. In this sense, it's more like IBM or Microsoft or Harvard or Yale. These are not the places that actually create new ideas. They're the ones that certify ideas on the fringes as central. I mean, that's my read as a libertarian. You don't have to. You don't have to. Tell me this. How do you self-identify? Do you consider yourself conservative? Do you consider yourself liberal? Do you consider yourself Jewish? Do you consider yourself a Midwesterner?
Jewish, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Very much.
Do you practice Judaism every day?
I don't know what that means.
Do you eat kosher?
No.
Do you keep kosher?
No.
Okay.
Grew
is
up
that your
keeping
hair or is it a wig? I don't know, I don't know if you're married or not, but
you can see my clavicle, so probably I'm not wearing a wig.
Okay. I thought that was a fake clavicle.
Actually, I'm in a costume.
Yeah.
But I'm in a full body suit.
Yeah, sure.
And
I would explain
I'm
the two guys with payas behind you and machine guns. So
it is Saturday and we are talking into a microphone.
Okay,
No,
but you didn't turn the microphone on and I'm your Shabbat's goyim then, right? I'm just like,
nice,
don't worry.
Nick.
Yeah.
Good reference. I would say that Judaism, it's hard to talk about it, right? Because it's different than other religions. It's more
God.
What?
Well, that's like what the Nazis said.
Oh, shut up. All I mean to say is that you can be extremely identified as a Jew and, not.
Yeah, it's a cultural identity as much as a theology. Certainly more than probably a theological
one. I cannot believe how tongue-tied I'm getting talking about this. I realize I don't talk
about
it that much.
You're getting a little verklempt.
I'm getting a little verklempt. Yes, definitely Jewish. And I would say Center left on certain issues, center right on others. I'm pretty boring, which is why the reaction...
That's coming through. Don't worry. Yeah, nobody's going to miss that.
Which is why the reaction has sort of like blown my mind a little bit.
So where, when you say center left on certain issues, well, center left on what issues? Are you pro-choice?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and so that must have led to interesting conversations in the Wall Street Journal's water cooler.
Yeah, although yes, at the water cooler, but the thing that made it sort of okay is that the journal doesn't editorialize on social issues almost ever in terms of our our unsigned editorials.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, oh yeah,
drugs,
yeah,
for example. You know, the most contentious arguments often are
silence,
between Mary O'Grady and Brett Stevens on drugs. So you know, silence says something, you can say that. The point is there was a tolerance for difference on those issues.
So then what...
Hawkish on foreign policy.
Yeah. So I mean, let me ask you this, and I'm asking
I have like an Upper West Side Jews politics. Okay. Like it's not...
and you have... you can get really good prices on carpeting, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. You can get the best deal
now
on
I just
carpeting.
Need like the Zabar's hookup and I'm set for life.
But... You know, what would it take, and this is an absurd question, but I've asked this of a bunch of conservative people or people who are identified with conservatism, and you are a conservative at the New York Times, even if you have this wider range. What is it that would make libertarianism your tribe? Like, how would that mean? Or what's the difference between being a conservative and a libertarian in your mind?
That's a good question.
Especially if you're pro-choice, if you're pro-gay marriage, if you're pro-at least pot legalization or saying, anything that's peaceful, why the fuck should anybody care how somebody's living unless they're
like
really...
Like, I'm with you on that.
Yeah,
keep
so that's
going.
All libertarian. And then is
but
it
then,
foreign,
like, foreign policy?
And is it foreign policy or is it Israel policy? Is it, to be honest, like... Among libertarians, I know people who are huge, they're not necessarily hawks, but they're huge Israel defenders. Mm-hmm. Or then there are people who are Israel haters, but would love us to go to war elsewhere or in defense of any other country except for Israel. Like they would love, for us to go to war, in Lebanon to protect against Israel or something like that. So to bring it back to that question is like,
what would make me a libertarian?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I guess I am libertarian leaning on many issues, certainly.
But
speech.
I don't
feel at home here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's definitely true. Like walking around the Freedom Fest.
Okay.
I mean, everyone's very friendly and nice, but like, it just seems like not my people.
Yeah, but have you gone to CPAC? I can't imagine you're walking around CPAC.
Kidding? Of course not.
Yeah,
this
these are my
like,
people, you know?
No, I just... Do I need to have my people though in that way? I'm not sure.
I'm just asking. But you would identify as a conservative?
No, I never said that.
Okay, no. Okay, that's interesting.
No, I mean like, I don't know. We can go down the list of issues. It's like,
but
why is it like? I find it. Why do you think I'm a conservative?
Because that's how you're pitched in public discourse about the Times, and you're the conservative hire. You have said things about free speech. You have said certain issues that, and without, if you're not identifying as a libertarian, then it's like, okay, well, you're a conservative and you worked at Tablet and you were at the Wall Street Journal.
Which is not conservative.
Yeah, but it's
not.
In terms of foreign policy.
But it's,
what's
its
position towards Israel?
Well, it has all kinds of positions on Israel.
Okay.
There's no unsigned editorials at Tablet. Right. They run
tons there's no unsigned anything at Reason, but we're libertarian. I mean, there's, you
yeah,
know,
but
there's
the idea that Tablet is conservative is just...
Commentary, you would say, is conservative.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Paleo-conservative or next-gen conservative?
No.
Next-gen neocon?
Yeah. Okay. Neoconservative.
What do you think somebody like Sam Tannenhaus, former book review editor at the New York Times?
Him, I don't know how I would. Yeah. How would
he's
you categorize
a, I
him?
I think he's a, and I've talked with him a bit about this, but I think he's a secret conservative.
Uh-huh.
But he lives in a world where to actually be that would be unspeakable.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I mean, he wrote a fantastic book about Whitaker Chambers, who I think is one of the dumbest people in American political history. And all you need to know about how dumb Whitaker Chambers was that he was a fucking communist. Like, and then we're supposed to give him credit for, switching to the losing side of history. It's like, no, I don't know. I mean, people who are fascists and communists generally aren't worth listening to. I mean, even when they reform. But Tannenhaus, what I'm getting at that when he was at Vanity Fair and elsewhere, and I love a lot of his writing, it just seems to me it's a shame that he couldn't fit that the intellectual landscape wasn't more varied so that he didn't have to be either a liberal or a conservative. But I think he has more in common with Bill Buckley, of whom he's writing a constantly, forestalled biography.
I have to say, I've not spent this much time thinking about my label.
I think about Tannenhaus all the time. It's like, it's not an obsession.
I just, honestly, I don't give a fuck about my label. Yeah, I know that no matter what I'm going to say, I'm going to be called, a crypto-Nazi right-wing fascist. So I just try not to think about
that. You do got to kind of, and this is, it's kind of the primitivism of this, of when Israel defenders are called Nazis. I mean, because it is so unspeakably vile, but it's so common.
Common. What am I going to do?
Like, these Israelis, they're as bad as the Nazis that gave the pretext for the state of Israel being founded. It's just mind-boggling.
Yes. I just honestly try. I know this is the lame cop-out thing to say, but I promise you that it's true. I really, really try and tune out the labels and try and write about issues. I would say my biggest challenge is to broaden the scope of what I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I really have to guard against in myself is that there's a self-radicalization that can happen when you're constantly attacked by the same sort of political tribe over and over and over again, that you come to focus inordinately on them and their excesses. And for me, that's the far left. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly I get it from I get tons of anti-Semitic emails and whatever from the far right. But the people that it hurts the most from are people on the far left, name journalists and other stuff. And so I have to guard against, honestly, getting hardened by that.
Well, and then becoming
writing about that all the time and that becoming my beat.
Well, and also, this happens predictably and and this is one of to go back to the intellectual dark web, the intellectual part of it is if you're constantly being attacked by, the far left as a shill for Israel or a neocon or whatever, at some point it's very common for people to say, fuck it, I'm going to be your worst nightmare.
Exactly.
And
that's
then
what
you
I
become
mean. That's the radicalization. Yeah. That's exactly what I mean. And I see that happening.
Yeah, I think it's happening with Brett Weinstein a little bit.
I don't think it's happening with Brett. I think it's happening with Dave Rubin.
Give it a little bit longer. I think it happened with Christina Hoff Sommers because she is now, in many ways, so anti anything that attaches to feminism. It's, because she rolls with a different crowd, and it's just you become. You want to become the worst nightmare of your dumbest critics or most extreme
and
persistent critics.
And my main, one thing that I've had to sort of really, really learn to do this year is to just, I don't want to become that.
Yeah.
I really, really don't. And that's sort of my main fear more than people calling me whatever they're calling me.
So what are the pieces that you find that you write that you get the most surprising response? So everything you write, you're going to get some people on the far left calling you a shill and you're this and fuck you. And you're going to get a certain amount of anti-Semitic email no matter what.
Yeah, of course.
But then what are
they're
the things?
They're often from college conservative or college Republican.
Yeah, which is
funny.
Yeah. So do you think, but so what are the pieces that you do that where people are like, fuck, I thought I had you figured out, or this is actually interesting. For me, in my career, the stuff that has always been most interesting is when I would appear on a show or write something which, where people, a couple of years ago, I was on Bill Moyers' show, and Bill Moyers and I share a couple of things in common, or a lot of stuff not in common. We both love Roger Williams, the religious separatist who co-founded one of the first Baptist congregations in America. A big fan of secular government and kind of peaceful transactions, all of this kind of stuff. And we're really anti-war. And then I was on one time talking about Citizens United, and it was I was debating Larry Lessig and Bill Moyers, and I was like, these guys are going to eat me for lunch. And I was like, Citizens United is about the right of political speech. And I got a bunch of people watching Bill Moyers who were there were like, I got to say, I expected to, disagree with you completely, but it was really interesting. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. And that kind of stuff is always fascinating. What are the pieces for you or the interventions into public discourse that...
I think that it surprised people early on. I wrote a piece about this former convict, Reginald Betts, who's also a poet, getting admitted to the Connecticut Bar. And a lot of people wrote me and they were like, can't believe you wrote that. And I'm like, really? Why not?
Yeah.
You know, I wrote a piece recently on just sort of like a feminist critique of beauty culture and what bullshit it is, pegged to the Miss America getting rid
of
the...
What is bullshit? The critique or that it persists, that it's like, yeah, you know, come on, let's push up the bra a little bit.
I find it very interesting that it's now couched in terms of like wellness and strength and like all of these euphemisms, but it's basically like, be a skinny bitch with big boobs or no one's going to pay attention. Yeah. Like that's still true.
Right.
And that was, you know, I got some nice response from people that I was surprised by. For sure, the biggest, the most viral piece was the piece I wrote about Aziz Ansari.
Right.
And people are constantly coming up to me and saying they're still debating it with like their
quickly,
kids.
Quickly give the thesis statement of that.
The thesis statement is... not every bad date or bad hookup, even if you regret it, is a Me Too incident.
Right.
And I would say the secondary and maybe more important point is, like, large parts of second wave feminism that have sort of fallen away for various reasons are really wise and true and should be revived. And the idea that, you know, a woman who is self-identifies as a feminist in 2018 would be on a date and not feel like hooking up with someone and not feel that she could say to him, I'm getting the fuck out of your apartment.
Right.
And sort of enduring it is really troubling to me. And I'm really interested.
Well, and it's not even clear that in that particular story that was published, I guess, originally at Bustle.
Babe, which no one had heard of until that.
It's not even clear that that's what the woman was doing, because it was a very kind of ambivalent interaction.
Right. Which, by the way, like every woman I know has had, including me.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like, does...
With Aziz Ansari?
Yes,
or the other Indian comic?
Oh, shit, Nick. But, only with Aziz.
Okay. Yeah. No.
Who I've never met, never spoken to.
Right.
Anyway. So that was interesting for me. I felt like... Again, I felt like this was like a very commonsensical thing, and I was sort of pretty... I knew it would be read, but I was shocked by the reaction
to it. And the reaction was mostly positive. There was
a very, very big mix.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying...
Women my age and younger were not pleased with it, I would
really?
Say. Yes.
Well, that's fascinating. And do you attribute
I've been told
that?
I have like old coding. Like, I'm technically a millennial, but... I have like old people ideas on certain things.
Well, and when
I
and second wave feminism, and it gets for me, it's easier because it just to talk about like say the feminism from the late 60s or mid 60s through about the mid 80s is very different than the way feminism gets talked about now, and where it's much more in a bizarre way is a kind of wilting flower feminism,
right?
You know, when you go back to people like Camille Polly or even Germaine Greer, Shulamith Firestone, who wrote The Dialectic of Sex, which is a great, and I say this in the fondest terms possible, like a great, insane work of vision.
Well, she was mentally ill, right?
Yeah, well, she ended up that way.
Yeah.
And essentially what she did is did a Marxist, she used Marxism as a frame for gender issues, and she just swapped out class, gender for class. And it's kind of brilliant, and again, nuts, but also totally necessary. And this is one of the things that I find appalling among a lot of libertarians and a lot of conservatives is that they are constantly going on and on about crazy feminists without understanding the context of like how we got to a place of relative gender parity, which was that women really had to be bitches and say, get the fuck away from me, and I want to be here, and I am, if I'm smarter than you or if I'm as smart as you, I should be your boss, and you have to learn to love it.
Yeah.
And people kind of forget that whole chapter. And I think it's as bad on the right as on the left.
I completely
for ignoring this whole era.
I completely agree with you. A crazy thing happened. I was in LA a few days ago, and I'm in a bar, and I'm there with someone and another woman, and this guy comes up to me, and he had sort of been trying to like, I guess, hit on us earlier, and walks by me. I'm sitting talking with her at a table, and just like pinches my upper arm. Like, just walks by and, like, grabs my flesh.
Right.
And I was just like, get the fuck off of me.
Right.
Like, what the fuck do you think you're doing?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just, I just find.
And that was Aziz Ansari?
And that was, that was my Aziz Ansari moment.
Okay, yeah.
But it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I find that So I'll give you an example. I have three younger sisters. My youngest mm-hmm. sister's 12 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And like when she was going to college at Michigan, she just graduated. She's the one working at the New York Post with the 25 inches for the story. I said to her, you know, things that I feel like I would get pilloried for if I wrote in a piece. Like, I don't give a fuck what people tell you. Don't show up at a frat house wearing a tiny outfit, mm-hmm. blackout drunk. It's just like right. basic common sense stuff, which is now framed
and
as like slut shaming to say that.
But it is, I mean, these two things are, you know, not mutually exclusive. That, yeah, that's not a wise choice to you know, to wear, you know, a small revealing outfit and get drunk.
Which, by the way, she would not do that. But I'm just saying.
But you know what? Most people in Michigan are like that. I mean, they who go to Michigan. But
it's also true that it's unjust and ridiculous that women have to think of those things.
No, what I was going to say is none of that absolves anybody who would like see a comatose person and then engage in some kind of sexual activity.
Obviously.
Yeah. But this
obviously,
is like we're,
but it's like if we talk about harm yeah. reduction at all,
right.
like you get killed for it.
Right.
It's like a slut
yeah.
shamer.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, I actually just don't want women to right. get raped. And until we live in that utopian society, which I don't see happening tomorrow,
and you're
I'm
going
to give that advice.
You're also not saying, because this is what a lot of people on the right, and I think this goes to a kind of Jordan Peterson mentality and stuff. And maybe not him specifically, but a lot of his followers. And this is why we need to be more conservative and traditional. And we need to teach boys, you know, they'll make fun of people saying teach men not to rape. But they're essentially saying we need a traditional social structure, which puts limits on the possible interactions
I'm
between
saying,
boys and girls.
I'm saying women need to be more mouthy.
Yeah.
And women need to be like, you know, women need to like use their words, including
right.
swear words,
yeah.
often if they're in situations that they're uncomfortable with. Like
right.
that was the thing in the Aziz story that I think struck me and many others is so disturbing. Mm. Like she was sort of like, I don't know, like
by,
like a passive actor
yeah.
in the
and interestingly, by her account, when she did use her words, he was like, oh, okay.
We're going to watch Seinfeld now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I just.
So, it, yeah. Oh, well, that's fascinating. You are a finalist for the Bastiat Prize. Do you know off the top of your head what you were nominated for?
What pieces?
Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea. I don't think they say that.
How did you even get involved in this?
Like, how am I here?
Yeah, I didn't know. I'm just asking.
Someone emailed me and said, you're nominated. And then I saw that other people, including Connor Friesendorf, were, and I was honored.
Yeah.
I never won anything
oh,
in my
yeah,
life.
No, it's a good, you know... It's a good group to be a part of, the finalists.
I'm excited, but
yeah.
I've literally... How do we find out what pieces they are? Because I have no idea.
I suppose I could pull it up on my computer, my internet lookup device, but it's that would be a little bit time-consuming. So I'm not going to do that,
okay.
But it has been a pleasure to talk with you on the Reason Podcast.
Thanks, Nick.
Barry Weiss.
Oh.
Is it Barry or Barry? Now I feel like
you know? Barry. Think like
Barry.
The animal.
Okay, so it's like the animal?
Like a bear. Barry.
Barry.
Oh, Barry,
okay.
Barry, whatever.
Okay,
I'm not correcting
yeah.
for that. It's
you know what?
Just like,
for a libertarian, you probably should say it's Barry, like Barry Goldwater. Okay, I
think
that's yeah.
Will
okay,
do.
Yeah. Keep that in mind. You know,
slouching toward libertarianism. I'll begin there.
Be able to code shift. Okay, code switch here. we've been talking with Barry Weiss. She is an opinion writer and editor for the New York Times. We are at Freedom Fest, the world's largest annual festival of libertarian people. At Paris in Las Vegas. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play Music, Reason.com, wherever you like to listen to podcasts, and let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.